Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Last Will by Bryn Greenwood, narrated by Tor Tom and Andrea Ems. Chapter 1. While You Were Out. When Joel reached toward the van door, I said, "Don't open it." Just the way my book on lucid dreaming told me to. The book said to contradict anything I didn't like, but Joel ignored me. "Well, hey, Bernie. What say we give you a ride home?" he said. "Shut up and go away." That didn't work either. Amy stood next to Joel, her white blonde hair fluttering in the breeze. Joel's fingers closed around the pitted chrome lever. Before I could protest, the door rolled open, and the back of the van gaped like the mouth of a hungry cave. He was in there. "I'm not doing this, and if this doesn't stop, I'm going to wake up," I said. Then I did. In that sense, the lucid dreaming worked. It kept away the nightmares, but it cost me sleep. Half an hour later, when my mother called, I had just fallen back asleep.
"Did I wake you?"
she said. "No," I said, even though I knew my voice was gravelly with sleep.
"It's not even 10 o'clock.
She cleared her throat.
"I'm afraid I'm calling with some bad news, Bernie."
"Are you okay?" She sounded fine, but in Boston it was nearly 11, late for her.
"Yes, I suppose. But Virginia just called to tell me Penn is dead."
When I didn't answer, she said,
"Did you hear me? Your grandfather Penn has died."
I got out of bed, opened the closet, and turned on the light. Looking for my suit, I fumbled through the clothes at the back. I saw already where the conversation was going. A trip to Oklahoma. "Did she say what happened?" I asked.
"A heart attack. He was nearly 90.
"I know. When's the funeral?"
"You'll need to make that decision, unless you're going to leave it all to Virginia, which I think is hardly appropriate. You really ought to decide."
"Okay," I said. There I was at the end of a long line of Raleighs. Whatever decisions there were to be made for my grandfather, I would have to make them. After I hung up with my mother, I felt myself drifting. The floor seemed less firm, and the bathroom tiles had already lost their tangibility. Afraid of drifting further, I brewed a pot of coffee and popped a few white crosses. Enough speed and caffeine to keep me awake for 2 days, or give me a stroke. I spent the night cleaning house and making lists until my eyes felt cooked in their sockets. By 6, I was on the phone buying my plane ticket. And at 8, I was standing at the Overland Park post office, filling out the paperwork that would commit me to having my mail forwarded to my grandfather's house. I went into work 2 hours late and stood at the front counter watching Ellen, the second assistant librarian, check a customer out. The only sounds in the library were the creaking of book spines, the discreet bleep of the scanner, the reassuring thump of the book cover, the intimate whisper as she slid the books across the counter to the customer. Under the counter, the printer chattered briefly. Ellen tore the receipt off and slipped it into the booktop. I let it wash over me, a little balance of pleasure to get me through the funeral, and whatever came after. My boss, Beverly, was shuffling papers at her desk, and when I told her about my grandfather, she gave me a gentle smile of condolence. She never spoke when a look would have the same effect. It was the thing that made her a superior librarian. "It's probably going to be a month at least, maybe longer," I said.
"Why so long?"
It wasn't a simple matter of an old man's house and car and checking account. I described the monumental nature of the task, the largeness of the estate, and when she still didn't understand, I told her that my grandfather was Penn Raleigh. Then I told her to read the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I saw the elements fall into place for her, like a Tetris game at work.
"I imagine a thing like that could take some time," she said. "It'll be fine, however long you need to be away."
I read in her look the things she would never say to me. They didn't really need me. Probably they never had. I went back to my apartment to get my suitcase and told the apartment manager I would be gone a while, leaving my car parked. He offered to start it and drive it occasionally, then said,
"Hey, you related to the Raleigh family in Oklahoma?"
The old guy just died and left a ton of money, my dad said.
It was the most he'd ever said to me, including the day I rented the apartment. After 20 blissful years as a nobody, I was somebody again. My grandfather's death didn't exactly leave me prostrate with grief, but at the funeral reception, I tried to be a dutiful grandson. Unfortunately, Maida Amos was a constant obstacle to my mournful sense of duty. I believe the polite word is domestic. She was one of my grandfather's domestics. She was always on some innocuous errand, bringing clean plates for the buffet or cleaning up a spill. At the moment, she opened the pantry door, crossed the dining room, and came into the formal parlor, where the dense Abusan rug absorbed the sound of her footsteps. Conversation ground to an uncomfortable halt. Maida Amos began to gather up some of the dirty dishes, ignoring the stares of hushed admiration. Clearly she was aware of the problem, because she'd done what she could to minimize it. She wore a featureless dress with an apron over it. Her hair was pulled back in a severe black knot, and she wore no makeup, no jewelry, none of the artificial trappings women used to beautify themselves. Honestly, she'd been disfigured, and still we couldn't look away. That was the root of the problem. There wasn't any angle at which she was other than breathtaking, and her allure wasn't diminished by the triptych of faded scars around her mouth. Two of them were more accurately the distinct halves of a single scar separated by her mouth, as though she'd had her lips tightly closed when the injury occurred. Her upper lip was sensually bowed, her lower lip a voluptuous invitation to a variety of obscene thoughts. I was grateful for the intervention of that scar. It slowed me down a little. The other scar was less dramatic, a secondary brushstroke above the left corner of her mouth. When my mother cleared her throat, I wanted to protest. No one else was shamed out of looking at Maida Amos by my mother's disapproval. Taking the cue, Aunt Jenny said, "You can leave that until later, dear. We don't need anything else just now." Maida nodded almost imperceptibly and left. The spell broke. People went back to telling stories about my grandfather. I imagine my brother Robbie remarking, "Ideally, the male of the species is the eye-catching one, because he has the numerical advantage of being able to reproduce with every female he can attract. For the female to hold that kind of magnetism, there's no benefit to the species." My mother leaned toward me and murmured, "You know what Penn's will contains. He's left it all to you. You must consider that there are a number of very rapacious people waiting to take advantage of this situation. You need to visit Mr. Twitey. Establish your position with the board of directors." I hoped I would get a pass on the conversation if I kept silent, but she leaned closer, engulfing me in a cloud of Chanel No. 5, and said, "Are you listening to me?"
"Yes."
"Well, answer me then."
I was considering telling her that she hadn't asked a question, but Father Reginald stood up at that moment and made his excuses for leaving. The other guests must have felt the tide had turned, because they began to make their farewells too, and I got up to see them out to their cars. When I came back into the parlor, I could tell my mother and aunt were annoyed with each other from the way they both smiled at me. Relieved. They reminded me of Nancy Reagan and Ryza Gorbachev, except that Aunt Jenny was much cuddlier than Ryza. To be fair, Nancy was cuddlier than my mother.
"Shall we have some dinner?"
my mother said. I went to help Aunt Jenny up from the sofa. As she took my arm, she smiled and said,
"What a nice watch."
"It's the one Dad gave Grandpa Penn for his birthday."
"A very nice watch, then. But it's a bit too big for you, sweetie. You need to have a link removed."
Aunt Jenny took up the slack with her finger.
"You should have had it buried with him."
My mother glared at me balefully. It never occurred to me. I felt like a cad. For the viewing, I'd given the funeral director my grandfather's wedding ring, his glasses, and a tie tack. I assumed they'd be buried with him, but I hadn't thought to include the watch any more than I had thought to bury him with his wallet or his car keys. It wasn't too late. He hadn't been buried yet.
"Oh, Catherine, I don't think Penn will need it where he's going,"
Aunt Jenny said, causing my mother to turn on her.
"That is not the point."
My mother swept out of the room, a thing at which she excelled, before we could respond. With the offending article on my wrist, I looked at Aunt Jenny, who'd suddenly become the arbiter of my relationship with my mother. "Nonsense, Bernie. It's a nice memento." After we finished dinner, Aunt Jenny and I went into the library, where my mother was reading a magazine. The room was just as I remembered it. Too warm, too full of light glinting off polished wood. I could barely keep my eyes open, so I got up and went down the shelves of books on the north wall. I bypassed the interminable classics, Aeschylus, Byron, Dante, Descartes, most of their green leather spines unmarred by reading. I learned at an early age that the unwieldiness of the books was intended as a stern warning against would-be readers. At one end of the top shelf was my father's secret stash of books, a testament to the cleaning regimen of my grandfather's housekeeper. The books were free of dust, but they hadn't been disturbed in years. I picked out The Moonstone and started reading. It's a book I find subtly pleasing, because no matter how many times I read it, or have read it, about four, I can never remember how the mystery is solved the next time I pick up the book. "I can't see how Bernie will manage this, even with an army of lawyers and accountants," my mother said. She pretended I was deaf when I was reading and I obliged. "It was Penn's choice," Aunt Jenny said. "He always did what he wanted. I'm only worried that Bernie won't be able to handle it. So many decisions to make. He's a smart boy. Everything will be fine. Of course he's not stupid, Jenny. But I wonder if it won't be too much for him. Emotionally. He's not strong. Not like Robbie." It was the point in my mother's disappointment when Robbie once would have stood up and suggested he and I go for a drive. Aunt Jenny was simply embarrassed, folding and refolding her hands in the lap of her black dress. "I'm sure he'll take care of it," she said. "We'll see." When I told him what I expect Penn's will contains, he shrugged. "And you saw that he's wearing Penn's watch. I don't see why that makes you so angry. The coroner brought Penn's personal items by, and Bernie took the watch out of the bag and put it on. From his grandfather's body directly to his wrist. I think that's gruesome beyond words, apart from the fact that the watch had great sentimental value for Penn." "Pooh," Aunt Jenny said. "The dead aren't sentimental. Burnham, do you hear me?"
"I hear you."
"Stop lurking and come sit down," my mother said in her dog-commanding voice. The pages of The Moonstone had been polished smooth by my father's hands, and as I turned them, they gave off a whiff of his aftershave. I took the book over to where she was sitting and fanned it open in front of her.
"What is it I'm reading?" she asked.
"Nothing. Just breathe in." She frowned and said nothing. The smell touched some part of her I couldn't. The next morning, my mother sat across from me at the breakfast table. She turned her magazine pages as if she were swatting at a fly. When I stood up to leave, she glanced at me as though she'd just noticed I was there and then went back to reading. She was leaving in the afternoon, and considering the fact that we only saw each other for family funerals, the math was on her side. There were two more funerals that would require our mutual presence. Three, if I included hers. And she wouldn't be forced to speak to me at that one. Because she'd insisted, I met with Mr. Twitey, the chairman of the board at Raleigh Industries. He was prepared, but for the wrong thing. In painstaking detail, his legal henchman explained that although I was inheriting a controlling interest in company stock, it was structured in such a way that an intricate web of executive officers, managers, and board members stood between me and the actual management of the business. It was the one concessionary plan my grandfather put in place after Uncle Alan's death, when he must have realized I was his only heir. In terms which left no doubt as to the generally held belief in my inability to succeed at anything, the lawyers explained to me that there was no need for me to be involved in daily operation of Raleigh Industries. They wanted me to serve on the board, and they wanted my name on the company's stationery. I was going to be a figurehead, trotted out at board and shareholder meetings and various community functions. I had such a reputation for incompetence that they suggested hiring an assistant to help me keep track of my little obligations. I don't know what response they expected from me,
but they tiptoed so delicately around the central issue that they must have been prepared for outrage. When they finished their presentation, I smiled and nodded in appreciation of their elaborate diplomacy. Leaning back into the leather chair that had been my grandfather's, I said the words they'd hoped for. I said, "Okay. My brother was being groomed to take over this business, but I'm a librarian." Everyone in the room exhaled in unison and smiled at me. I felt like an ass for playing the simpleton, except I was relieved too. What would I have done if my grandfather's dying wish had been for me to run the company? Killed myself and let the inheritance roulette wheel stop on someone else? "You were wrong to worry," I told my mother when I came back from the meeting.
"What do you mean?"
"There's no need for me to establish my position over at RI. I don't have one."
"That's outrageous. They can't push you out."
"They can't, but Penn did." I wanted to get the last word, to end the conversation. "Don't be upset. I'll still receive the dividends, the income. I just won't be making any decisions about the company. That's what Grandpa Penn wanted." She didn't say anything else, except to tell me she was ready to go to the airport. With the big white house looming in my rearview mirror, and the line of trees that hugged the driveway reaching their bare limbs up to the winter sky, I felt my mother's relief. She was glad to be going. Glad to be leaving behind all that good red dirt in that drafty old mansion. And me. On the drive into Oklahoma City, she had nothing to say to me, and I found myself filling the quiet by describing the plot of the Moonstone as far as I could remember it, all the while hating myself for caving to her impenetrable silence. This was her idea of goodbye.
"Oh, here we are. Take care of yourself."
She strode out onto the tarmac, her purse over one arm. And at the top of the stairs to my grandfather's jet, she gave me a little wave. Very Jackie. She had quite a repertoire of first ladies.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Raleigh,"
Mrs. Bryant said when I got back to the house. She had been my grandfather's housekeeper for close to 20 years, and she had a way of moving that advertised her arthritis. Stiff and careful. She calculated each movement before she made it. When she resigned, she would apologize and mention her health. She would not want me to feel that I was the reason she was leaving. But the truth was evident to us both. When a new tyrant takes the throne, the old tyrant's faithful retainer goes to the chopping block. I wasn't even sufficiently tyrannical for her taste. She waited for me to tell her what to do, and when I didn't, she did what needed to be done. When she'd asked me about hiring extra help for the funeral, she was disappointed that I deputized her to do what she thought was best. Mrs. Bryant had a clear notion that there was a sacred order to the world. It started with God, the Pope, then descended through the ranks of the church until it ultimately reached Mrs. Bryant. But in her mind, her employer came ahead of her. I personally had always ranked the hierarchy of importance on usefulness, leaving me somewhere near the bottom. I wasn't sure where God fit in.
"What would you like for your lunch, Mr. Raleigh?"
she asked.
"Mr. Raleigh usually preferred a roast beef sandwich on Tuesdays. Of course, you can have whatever you'd like."
Feeling like an imposter, I agreed to prefer roast beef on Tuesdays also. Over the next few days, I learned to exist at the periphery of the cleaning that went on throughout the house. Mrs. Bryant had her two temporary helpers, Maida Amos and Mrs. Krause. And the three of us had an unspoken pact to pretend we couldn't see each other when we passed in the hallways. At first, the only evidence of the phone calls was in the regularity with which Mrs. Bryant poked her head around the door and said,
"The phone for you, Mr. Raleigh."
Then I discovered that if I went up to my bedroom and shut the door, she wouldn't disturb me. It was the easiest solution to the phone calls, but after several days the evidence mounted. A pile of phone messages written on little pink pieces of paper that said,
"While you were out."
They gathered in drifts across my grandfather's desk. The messages were all the far-flung particulates of my grandfather's personal affairs. The people who called were assistants of attorneys, accountants, brokers, caretakers, consultants, and representatives from dozens of museums and collections. I didn't bother to count the calls from the news agencies, imagining the phrase, "could not be reached for comment," printed after my name. I made haphazard attempts to return some calls.
but I didn't have a particular system, and found that despite the best intentions, I couldn't develop one. Maybe they weren't the best intentions, but they were good intentions, arrayed one after another like so many paving stones. My failure was undeniable when the same names made third and fourth appearances, and the messages took on a tone of barely contained anxiety. Questions needing answers. I woke up each morning to discover the ceilings had been lowered while I was asleep. Every day the rooms in the house seemed smaller. I was a lobster put to boil on a low fire, feeling the water heating, but not realizing what the outcome of the hot bath would be. By the time I realized what was happening, it was too late, or I never realized it at all. It was that late. I was a seafood metaphor. I didn't know how many days went that way. I never did. I lost track until I heard someone talking to me. I inhaled, smelling the dry, preserved familiarity of my bedroom, and over it, the scent of jasmine. A woman, not my mother. It was the funeral stopper, Maida Amos. She stood next to the bed, looking down at me, and said, "Mr. Raleigh, your aunt is here to see you." When I sat up, she took a step backward, but I felt her looking at me, staring really, breaking the little agreement we'd had.
Creepy, Maida. I wasn't thrilled about working for Aunt Bryant again, but I was glad to get the money, even though it meant leaving Anador with Grandma. The money for groceries had to come from somewhere. The work wasn't bad, because it wasn't like being a maid at a motel, which was the worst job I ever had. Mostly, it was just keeping up with the way dirt sneaks in everywhere in a big old house. We didn't see much of Mr. Raleigh, which was fine with me, because I thought he was a little creepy. Not in a bad way, just kind of goofy and distracted. Aunt Bryant got nervous when we hadn't seen him in a couple days, and the dinner tray we left out on the kitchen counter one night wasn't touched at all. Nancy knocked on his bedroom door, but he didn't answer, so Aunt Bryant said we ought to open the door and have a peek, just to be sure he was okay. I didn't feel like messing around, so I knocked louder and heard Mr. Raleigh mumble, "What? What is it? Do you want me to make up your room?" I said, like it was a motel. "No, thank you." I shrugged at Aunt Bryant, but she kept frowning. When I asked what she was worried about, she said, "Now, I better not ever hear this come back to me, because I won't have you gossiping about the Raleigh family." She waited until Nancy and I nodded. After his father and brother died, he took a whole bottle of pills that the doctor gave Mrs. Raleigh for her nerves. The evening after the funeral, his uncle went up to the room at the top of the stairs, just by chance, you know, because there must have been somebody using the downstairs washroom. Mr. Allen went up and found him, came downstairs white as a ghost, shouting for us to call an ambulance. It gives me a chill remembering that. Mary Beth's Donald was a volunteer paramedic then. He says Mr. Raleigh was dead when they got here. They had to use the paddles on him.
"You don't think he would again?" Nancy said.
"Oh, I don't think so. He was just a boy then," Aunt Bryant said, but she looked upset. The next day, Mr. Raleigh's aunt came to see him and asked me to let him know she was there. He didn't answer, even though I knocked really loudly, so I went into the room. He was sleeping, curled up on his side. His hair was matted to his head like he hadn't washed it in a while. When I said his name, he rolled over on his back and looked up at me. Then he sat up and looked around.
"Could I have some water, please?" he said.
He was so hoarse, I wondered how long it was since he drank anything. I filled the glass on the nightstand, and when he finished that, I got him another glassful, and he drank that too. While he was drinking it, I looked at him sitting there in his underwear. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I couldn't help myself, because I'd never seen anyone like him. Without his clothes, he was bigger than I thought, but too thin. Just big, raw bones, and not much meat on him. The way he was built, he looked like a giant 10-year-old, all arms and legs. While I was watching him finish his water, his aunt came upstairs.
"That's fine, dear, thank you," she said. That meant I was supposed to leave. Weakness, Aunt Ginny. After I'd sent Miss Amos out, he said,
I'm sorry.
He apologized because he'd been taught to think of it as his fault. His mother had never believed in his depression as a thing apart from his character. It was why she thought he was weak. You haven't been eating, I said.
I'm sorry.
Are you taking your medicine?
No.
Oh, Bernie, what would your mother say? It nearly broke my heart to see him that way. He was even thinner than he'd been as a young man, when he was struggling to grow into his height. When you love another woman's child the way I love Bernie, you put your trust in God to keep you close, because no one else thinks of your bond as special. No one consults you when they're making decisions about his future. Yet there he was, brought to me, for me to take care of. Whatever Catherine chose to believe about her sons, Bernie was as capable as Robbie had been. He just hadn't seen the thing he was meant to do.
Please, don't call my mother. Please, he said.
I was ashamed for scolding him, and for having thought of calling Catherine. Seeing the state he was in, I couldn't bring myself to do it. He didn't need her judgment or her doctor's as much as he needed some kindness. No, I won't call her. I took off my glove, meaning to check him for fever, but when I tried to put my hand on his forehead, he shied away. I know she's a little hard on you, but you have to look at things as a whole. You know, when your grandfather was a little boy, no one thought he would amount to much. They used to call him Penny because he misbehaved so much and had a way of turning up at the wrong time, just like that old saying about bad pennies.
That's apocryphal, he said.
I beg pardon?
It's not true, that story. People like the story, so they keep telling it. Nobody ever called that man Penny.
Yes, I know what apocryphal means, I said, a bit annoyed with his $10 words. I only wanted you to see that life isn't all set out for you. People change, and I think you should let an old woman tell her stories.
I'm sorry.
Do you still pray, Bernie? Would you like me to pray with you? He shook his head and wouldn't look at me. I loved him so much, and he was returned to me a stranger again. Secretly, I had always believed God sent Bernie as a blessing to Alan and me, to make bearable what might have crushed me under its weight. It seems shameful, considering how young he was, but there were many times I cried on his shoulder, especially after Joan died. He never used those stabbing words that adults offer. She's gone to a better place. You have to keep on living. There will be other chances. It must be God's will. They appear to offer comfort, but behind them all are the suggestion that you ought to stiffen your spine and stop crying. I once thought Bernie would make a great minister, because when he was only 5 years old, he knelt down and prayed with his grandmother in her final hours. He had such healing in him, such compassion, and they saw to it that he became nothing inside. They made him into an observer.
Well, why don't you take a shower, and then we can go have some lunch, I said, trying to be cheerful.
I'd forgotten how angry I was at the Raleigh family, and I felt the sort of fury that isn't healthy for an old woman to feel. Once he was in the shower, he must have felt better, because I heard him singing. That seemed more like the Bernie I knew, and just because he chose not to, it didn't mean I couldn't pray for him.
Changing the guard. After Aunt Ginny left, I met up with Mrs. Bryant in the front hall and waited for her to say, "Good afternoon, Mr. Raleigh." Instead, she reached into her apron pocket, presented me with a handful of message slips, and said, "I need to speak with you, Mr. Raleigh." 5 minutes later, she was sitting on the other side of my grandfather's desk, looking over the piles of phone messages at me. "Mr. Raleigh and I had discussed me retiring. My health isn't what it used to be,
What with the author.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?